Hello and welcome to the IMD Podcast Network. Today, Vanina Farber, ELIA Professor of Social Innovation, and Catherine Milligan, Senior Lecturer at the Geneva Graduate Institute and ELIA Fellow at IMD, speak with Carlos Alvarez Pereira, Secretary General of the Club of Rome. This international think tank brings together scientists, policymakers, business leaders, and civil society to address complex global challenges. Its ultimate goal is global equity on a peaceful and healthy planet. Their conversation explores the fundamental transformations shaping international development today.
Welcome to IMD Podcast, Exploring the Future of International Development. I'm joined by Carlos Alvarez Pereira, the Secretary General of the Club of Rome, an international think tank advancing evidence-based systemic solutions to global challenges facing humanity, no more, no less, and Catherine Milligan, who's an ELIA Fellow here at IMD, and also thought leader and well-known advisor on social innovation and systems change. So welcome both of you to this hopefully candid conversation on a very pressing issue that I think is also a bit sensitive. So I think we're going to have an interesting round. So let me start by quoting your recent article in DevEx. The international development system we knew is gone, and there is no going back. What comes next depends on how we choose to respond. Very provocative. So what motivates you to frame the current situation in this way? And what are the key messages that we can draw people's attention to? So let's start maybe, Carlos, if you want to start the conversation.
Yes, very happy. Thank you, Vanina, and thank you, IMD, for this opportunity to share our ideas from Catherine and myself. The reason why we adopted that perspective is to make clear that in the system of international cooperation for development, all three words have changed substantially their meaning since the concept was first designed and set up, which happened many years ago. International relations are very different from what they used to be even just 5 or 10 years ago. Division of the world into developed and developing is more and more questioned. Who is developed and who is not, you know? The emergence, of course, the re-emergence of many countries that were put in on that side of developing world is a fact. Second, the concept of cooperation, I think, has to be looked at again in an approach closer to mutual learning than just developed countries helping developing countries to reach a state of development. The concept itself of development is also under revision because we all aspire to have a planet where well-being for humans is balanced with the planetary boundaries. So these are long-term structural changes, and this is why we say there is no way back. But the realization of these changes have been, of course, accelerated by very recent events like the decisions of the U.S. administration to cap the funding of USAID. And this is not an anecdote. Those recent events have to be put in the context of these long-term structural changes to produce something else, to make also to create a momentum to produce something new, not to say, oh, there is no way to continue this work at all.
Catherine, on your side, what was also your motivation?
Thank you so much for having us. I guess we wanted to deliberately be provocative as a way to pierce through the denial. You know, there's a lot of the initial responses to power through, let's make do with less, you know, we just need to hang on for 4 years, you know, everything's going to return back to normal. No. Right? It's not just the closure of USAID. It's not just reduced funding flows. You know, we're also seeing the rules, the norms, the values, and the beliefs underpinning the system tip in real time. And so trying to call that out, trying to name it so we can make decisions accordingly rather than waste precious time with wishful thinking, you know, that's vital for all of us, not just in Geneva International or, you know, multilateral institutions, but for social enterprises, for nonprofit leaders, local CSOs, et cetera. So this notion of tipping points is evocative, and the system of international cooperation for development is tipping. It is transforming. There is no going back to what was, and what was not sustainable for some time already, right? And we all know that too. So we have to name that, even if it's uncomfortable to say, and even if it's still unclear what's going to emerge out of the other end of this process. And so I guess when many of us are feeling distressed by the forces that are shaping this transformation process and feel helpless to do anything about it, that's really the second message that we wanted to bring, right? It's that we do have choice. We do have agency at all levels, even though it might not feel that way. You know, our actions do matter, no matter how, you know, small or insignificant they may seem. And so when those old patterns are collapsing, what emerges on the other side isn't inevitable, but it really is a product of all of these choices, right, that we're making and how we respond to our present moment.
What do you see on the road on these kind of choices, on the mindset, on the things that are happening? What is there for, if you want, a little bit more on the mood of the organizations and what you feel is happening?
The institutional reaction is always the consequence of personal reactions. You know? Institutions are made by people, and with all the consequences it has. And the very usual message that we were hearing, you know, in the International Geneva at the beginning of the year was, oh, the system is crumbling down, the system of international cooperation for development, and we have no alternative. So this was also a spark for the discussions with Catherine and for writing this article. How is it possible? You know, there are different ways of reacting. And what has been happening, not only in this context, reminds me of Greek tragedies, where you have an oracle making a prophecy about the future, about something very bad happening in the future, and the protagonist reacts to that from fear, from a combination of denial, anger, and fear. And then by doing that, and this is the big wisdom that is in those pieces of, you know, ancient mythology, by doing that, what he does is to accelerate the conditions for that prophecy, that tragedy to become true. Self-fulfilling prophecy, right? So we felt a strong push to say, no, you can do otherwise. You can react to what has been happening with other capacities, other resources, not in a defensive way, you know, which has been largely the reaction we have seen. Defensive meaning, oh, but this is a bad situation, but at some point in the future, we will come back to what we had. Like saying, though, the system was good, you know, something very bad happened, but we will come back. No, you have to build. And there are options to build an alternative. You know?
What comes to my mind when you ask that question, I was sitting in a room with about 30 international organization leaders, and we were discussing reimagining multilateralism. And it was a purely, you know, hyper-rational, technical, you know, sort of chock-a-block PowerPoint slides, right? Here's all the reforms and policies. There was no acknowledgement of the human dimension, right, of any of this. And I think that's the, you know, what Carlos is trying to point to as well, right? Institutions are made up of people, right? We kind of think about it as this big unwieldy system that's crumbling. But actually, all of us inside the system, you know, have agency and have choice. So that's on one end of the spectrum, right? A total, let's say, denial response that's, you know, again, very analytical, hyper-rational, and technical. On the other end, you know, a couple of other anecdotes. I was on a call this week with leaders debriefing their COP experience from Brazil, and one of them said the fear is just palpable, right? So many fear-driven decisions being made right now, and such an intense feeling of injustice and moral outrage. And just yesterday, I bumped into a neighbor who works for a UN agency, and just, you know, unbidden, he said, most of my colleagues are in distress, and he didn't know how to handle it. You know, he really was totally mystified and at a loss for what to do. So I just, you know, what am I seeing? I'm seeing that distress at many levels. It's at the level of the disruption that people are facing in their career and their life. And will I have a job in 6 months? Or if you're a smaller organization, will our organization still be around in a year? It's an existential distress about, like, you know, my identity, the meaning that I've imbued into my work for years, for decades. Many humanitarian workers, many development workers, right, derive their sense of self, their professional identity from a sector that's melting down. So there's this crisis of meaning. And then, of course, there's that meta level, right, distress about, you know, these are issues that we really all care so deeply about. Vulnerable communities who are being harmed by the way, you know, this disruption. And so this backsliding on progress, this retrenchment, you know, that's taken years to achieve on climate, on gender, right, on education. It's impossible to ignore this raw emotion, right? Whether we openly talk about it and acknowledge it in the rooms where the decisions are being made or not is there. It's present. Anxiety, dread, fear, moral injury. It's widespread, and it's in the relational spaces between us as well, right? Between team members, across departments, in the rooms where decisions are being made. And a lot of us feel really alone in trying to process these intense emotions because we don't have spaces to be able to name it and to do it in. And like my neighbor, many of us really just don't feel equipped to handle the distress, you know, that our colleagues are in as well. And so, you know, you ask, what am I seeing? I think that is producing a lot of the behaviors that we're seeing, right, at the individual and the organizational level, whether that's, you know, the withdrawal or the workaholism, the controlling behavior or the denial and the numbing out, right? It's producing a lot of this activity in the system.
If I may add, because this is really key, I think, what Catherine said, you know, we are not saying that those emotions are wrong. So anger, fear, anxiety, depression, denial, all that. They are not wrong emotions. And we are not saying either that, oh, we have to be rational, because that does not exist. We don't take any decisions. We humans are at the same time emotional and rational. You know, emotions are part of our intelligence. So we are not denying the gravity of the situation. We are saying, beware of the decisions you are making from a certain mental framework, which is built on negative emotions like denial, anxiety, etc. Because there might be another option. If institutional decisions are made based on that, that can have long-term consequences for the evolution of the system of which you are part. While there are other options, but for those other options, you have first to consider. Start with acknowledging the emotions in which you are in and digging into that in order to get to another framing with more positive emotions.
And it's what you said as well, right? If we are in these activated states, these, you know, kind of fear-driven states, that's really shaping what we're able and willing to see, right, as potential courses of action. So it is a both and, you know, particularly in the sense of how these decisions get made, how they're communicated, right? How can we be more humane, even if things need to sunset or end with grace or, you know, kind of shift gears or be localized? And of course, many of those shifts are long overdue. And how do we maintain our integrity while also engaging with the fear, right? It's not that it's not there and we deny it as its existence, but we've got to, for me, it always comes back to starting within, right? We have to start by regulating our own emotional states, bring them into our conscious awareness so that what we're contributing in these rooms, right, is sort of calm, you know, kind of healthy, compassionate ways of contributing to decision-making processes and also of, you know, kind of managing, engaging with, supporting our colleagues too and other teams, right, who are experiencing distress, including our emotional partners.
So on your side, Carlos, what do we do? How do we transform? I think Catherine started in the personal side, but also how do we translate these perspectives into practice?
Well, I think first by recognizing the depth of the issue, which is not, as said earlier, you know, it's the issue is of a structural nature, because the world is very different from the one that existed when the current multilateral institutions were created, you know, which was just after the Second World War, and at a time many countries were still colonies, just to say something, you know, and many countries which have been destinations of this concept of cooperation for development were, when the multilateral system was created, still formally colonies. And what we have seen in the world has many different readings, but we have seen the capacity of many countries to affirm their own path to development. And this is obvious in many ways. Just take the example of China, but there are many more. And overall, this is a very positive thing for humanity. Problem is, the consequences of that, or some of the consequences of that, are questioning the system we had for international cooperation for development. So the first exercise for me is to have these kind of conversations like this one we are having now, where people can express, we have to stop this dissonance. I mean, one of the worrying aspects of all this is the dissonance between the official discourse and what people really feel. And that's very toxic for everybody, including for the institutions. So have the conversations, and typically those conversations would start with a series of monologues expressing frustration and bad emotions. You have to go through that to get to the point where you start first creating the energy, the collective energy of people connecting together, feeling, oh, we are in this together, and that positive energy to be directed towards, well, let's recognize the world as it is and what is needed, you know, because it's really interesting to see, for instance, how in the Club of Rome, the reaction of my African colleagues to the cutoff of USAID was largely an expression of, it's more than time that we get into another mode, not based on dependency from funding coming from the US or the West in general, you know, to address our own needs, you know. So an expression of self-affirmation to go forward and to design responses for the future. So there is an extraordinarily positive, I think, positive side to it. How can this get to the community of international development so that it can learn? This is a learning exercise, deep learning, and it can innovate how it works across countries, you know? So that's the collective intelligence cannot happen if you don't start by creating the conditions. It's an emergence rather than a linear process. You have first to create the conditions for people to share and to express themselves and to start being actually creative.
I would add to that, our response in this time cannot look like the response of business as usual. Right? Sort of, it has to look categorically different. And leaders want to show control, want to show, you know, right, exercise leadership, demonstrate that they know what to do. On the contrary, I think there's a lot of power in leaning into not knowing, in acknowledging your vulnerability, your, you know, whatever you might be feeling, which then creates a psychological safety for the people around you to be able to do the same, sort of try and bridge that dissonance that Carlos was speaking about, create that coherence so that it's not one set of, you know, kind of set remarks on a panel. And then in the break time, everyone's scrambling and, you know, what's happening? But we're not talking about the real issues. You know, how do we create more of that coherence between those conversations? And rather than sort of command and control and imposing top-down decisions, how is it that we think about you know, kind of participatory foresight methods, you know, scenario planning, horizon scanning, sort of sense making, you know, sort of that we are detecting, you know, weak models, we're interpreting trends, and we're doing it collectively, right? So there is this notion of, as Carlos said, you know, kind of enabling collective intelligence, okay, that occurs in this transformation process, which increases, you know, sort of the buy-in, the ownership, the chances for success of the transformation process itself, right? A coherent process, a humane process, a process that embodies the spirit, the ethos, the values, right, of development, cooperation, solidarity, inclusion, et cetera, is what maximizes our chance for success and for renewal of the system itself.
Well, you know, I made this analogy with Greek tragedies. And what we are proposing in a nutshell is, instead of choosing fear as the place from which you react, it's definitely choosing hope and love as the place from which you react to something which has initially a very negative look, you know. But not hope in the sense of optimism, of naive optimism, oh, things will be okay. No, hope as an active attitude. In the Club of Rome is generally known for the book, the report, No Limits to Growth. In 1979, we published another report titled No Limits to Learning, betting exactly on the capacities of humans that we are here invoking. And we are now working in a continuation of that No Limits to Learning framing, and we decided to call it No Limits to Hope. So I think this is the framing from where we have to address these crises, but also many others. I mean, we are not running short of crises and possibilities and opportunities for transformations.
This harm, while real, also opens a space for possibilities. And it's an opportunity to lean into that while not ignoring the harm and the distress. That's real. But when we are dysregulated or activated ourselves, literally, in our own nervous systems, we compound that distress. So again, I come back to the self, right? We can't control all those forces out there. We can control or contribute to what's in our sphere of influence. And settled bodies, settle bodies. So cultivate, first and foremost, a regulated nervous system within yourself, which then extends outward to the people around you. And wherever possible, you know, act with compassion and with grace. We all need more grace in these times.
Thank you so much for, you always find me on the side of hope, love, hopefully self-reflection, and I would say learning. And I think in a wider view, we see these kinds of, in a different way, but even in corporates in the current times, I think a lot of the competencies of the past of doing our core things are showing limits, and how we build new competencies, how we act in this uncertain environment is kind of fateful. But when you have a tribe of people that want to share the journey with you, I think it gets easier and there's more opportunities for innovation. At least having you both here gives me hope and willingness to keep innovating and working together. So thank you for joining me here at IMD. And looking forward to keep working, because as you said, this is just the beginning of the road and there are really important issues to be dealing with. Thank you so much.
Thank you to you.
That's all for this week. This podcast was proudly brought to you by the International Institute for Management Development in Lausanne. You can find out more at imd.org.